sprechen. Ich kann ein bisschen von Deutsch sprechen, aber wenn ich in Deutschland komme, alle Leute mir sagen, oh, you speak English. So my accent must be very poor, obviously, and I have some grammar problems. So I can't deliver a talk in German, although I would really like to. So I appreciate you indulging me to speak in English. I want to start out by giving some of my history. I've been involved in GPL compliance and enforcement for longer than anyone, probably than Richard Stallman. And I first worked on a GPL enforcement matter in 1999, when I was volunteering for the Free Software Foundation, and Richard Stallman, who's more commonly known as RMS and is the president of FSF, emailed me and said, would you like to review a source code release that we've received from a company who has violated the GPL and they're coming into compliance? So that was the first time I did what's called a CNCS check, or a complete and corresponding source code check. I'm going to talk more about what that means later. Eventually, I convinced RMS to hire me to work at the Free Software Foundation. I worked there from 2000 until 2005, and most of my work there was involving GPL enforcement. Not most, but a large amount. I went to work for an organization in the United States called the Software Freedom Law Center for 5 years, where I had a good part of my job involved with GPL compliance and enforcement. Today, I'm the executive director of the Software Freedom Conservancy, which has a number of member projects that are open source and free software, some of which are under the GPL or LGPL, and we do GPL enforcement for them. And I'm also now on the board of directors of the FSF, which continues to do GPL enforcement. When I look back at my history in work for the last 12 years, it hasn't been that a majority of my time has been spent on GPL enforcement. But when I look at all the different things I've done, the plurality, or the largest single thing I've worked on, has been GPL enforcement. Somehow, this has become my life. I'm not completely happy about that, but it is true. So when I look at the free software community now, initially I just started it, like everyone else, as a volunteer, doing some programming, answering questions on mailing lists, but now everything I look at is through the eyes of someone who enforces the copyleft. And ultimately, I see the free software community as two different groups. There are the permissively licensed folks, the ones who choose the Apache license or the BSD license or any of the other licenses that are not copyleft. And it's not that they don't want all the software to be released as free software. It's just not required by their license. So they use various forms of social pressure. A very good example is Theo de Rott of the OpenBSD project has a certain interpretation of the BSD license that I call copyleft by guilt, which is that if you don't release your code to OpenBSD, all the OpenBSD minions will be emailing you saying, why haven't you released your code? You should release your code. I don't see how that's any more permissive, really, than the copyleft in some ways, because it's quite annoying. But of course, the copyleft licenses, the GPL, the LGPL, and some others as well, less used, the license requires that you release the software. And I have spent most of my time, although I do work with many permissively licensed projects, I spend most of my time with copyleft projects. So my stories are the stories of this world of copyleft, and I see it as a distinct world. And it's not that we don't still use some social pressure. I don't recommend Theo's method, which is a little bit aggressive, but it's usually useful to attempt to convince a company that has failed to violate the GPL, or failed to comply with the GPL, to come into compliance by asking them, by putting a little pressure on them from the community. And if that fails, that's when we do GPL enforcement. We don't do it until we're sure that someone's not going to come into compliance on their own or through social pressure. And I apologize, it's a little US bias, but I grew up in the US, so I tend to think this way. In the US, we have this thing called the Constitution, which is the written down embodiment of the core principles that our country is supposed to follow. We don't actually, unfortunately. But the document's pretty good as a written down embodiment of principles. In theory, it's very good. And so I see the GPL as that. And it basically is an implementation. If you think of the four freedoms of free software as merely an algorithm, an idea, the GPL is the implementation of that idea. So it makes sure that you have the freedom to run the software and study it, that you can improve it by making modifications. Of course, you need the source code and the ability to build it and install it to do that. And you have the freedom to give it to other people if you like. You can give it commercially or non-commercially. And once you make some improvements, you can sell those improvements for money, or you can give them away by posting a patch to a mailing list. These are the four freedoms that you're supposed to get with free software. And GPL is designed to make sure that you get them, at least in theory. So it has the same problem as the US Constitution. In theory, our country is supposed to be free back in the United States, but in practice, sometimes we're not. It's very similar with copyleft. In theory, what GPL does is it uses this idea of copyright, and it picked copyright in part because it's relatively standard internationally. Most countries have signed, at least in the industrialized world, have signed the Berne Convention on Copyright. There are differences between the European and the US copyright systems, but generally, they're somewhat harmonized through the Berne Copyright Convention. So using a copyright license, we can grant people all these permissions to do all these things that are important. This is what Linux does, this is what all the copyleft software does when it's licensed under GPL. The difference between a permissive license and a copyleft license is those permissions are conditional on making sure everyone else gets them. This is the share and share alike idea, and the GPL implements that idea in some text by laying out the principles and building the requirements. Well, this is the hack that RMS came up with on how to hack copyright law to defend software freedom. And we use then the copyright rules to require compliance with the license, because in the end, we're actually just using copyright law. So we have this thing sitting there that's usually used for other things, like trying to stop people from copying, sharing, and modifying, and we have to use that to try and make sure people respect the freedoms. So that's where theory sort of starts to end and the practice begins. So what happens if someone fails to respect your software freedom, to give you copies of the software, to give you the right and the ability to modify and improve it? What if the social pressure fails? What if you ask them for the source code and they don't give it to you? What if the community gets upset that the source code hasn't been given? What do we do? Well, we have to go back to using copyright law. We have to use copyright enforcement the same way, in some ways, as the MPAA in the United States does and other different copyright holders of movies and music do to stop people from file sharing. I realize the irony that I'm using the same system they are. I don't particularly like their methodology. For example, I believe fundamentally that copyright infringement should never be criminal. It's not a crime, in my view, to infringe copyright, and all the enforcement that we do of GPL is civil enforcement, not criminal. We don't call the police up and ask them to stop people who have violated the GPL. So that's a big difference between us and the MPAA, but there is a little bit of irony there that I must admit. And I live with this irony because I believe what we're doing is for a good cause. We're defending the freedoms of users, their rights to copy and share and modify the software. So I'm willing to use the tools of the oppressor against the oppressor in some sense, to make sure that we use copyright law in a way that defends people's rights to copy and share and improve software. Now, there's a history to this. Copyleft didn't exist in the beginning. It didn't come into existence with copyright law. Copyright law is hundreds of years old, and copyleft is only about 30 years old, 35 maybe. GNU Emacs was the first program ever to be under copyleft. In fact, it was so early in the history of copyleft that GNU Emacs wasn't under the GPL initially. It was under something called the Emacs Public License. And it was only later that the general public license, GPL, was invented by RMS. In fact, it points out to a confusion a lot of people have of what general means or was originally intended to mean in GPL. Well, first of all, people think the G stands for GNU. Well, it actually stands for general. So once you get past that confusion, the next thing people think is it's a license for the general public, which it is, after all. But that's not why RMS picked the name General. He picked the name General because he had the Emacs public license and he generalized it to work on any other program. And that's why he originally called it the General Public License. So Emacs eventually is under the GPL and it still is today, but I've never heard of a case where the copyright of Emacs was infringed, where the GPL was violated. I'm not really sure why this is true. I think it's probably true because most of the people who use Emacs are developers and people who otherwise would be fans of the GPL. So I just don't think anybody's ever said, well, I can put this Emacs thing in my product and make a lot of money. I don't think anybody would actually buy a product based on Emacs. They could just download it from GNU.org. The second copyleft program was GCC. It was much more interesting to companies. The idea of having a compiler was something that targeted many different architectures and supported many different languages as inputs on the front end. This is something companies thought they might want to proprietarize. And this is, of course, where the first GPL violation came from. Does anybody want to guess who, as far as this is my own research, I don't know for certainty, but I'm pretty sure this is the first GPL violator. Does anybody want to guess who it was? Correct, almost. It was Steve Jobs, but it was when he was at Next, before he came back to Apple. He had decided, well, I need to write Objective-C, and I want to make this language, which we know today is the default language of iOS, but it was developed back at Next. And he said, well, I need a compiler, so what I'll do is I'll download this GCC thing, I'll make an Objective-C front end, and I'll release that as object code only, and then people will have to link my object code for the Objective-C front end with the upstream GCC and get a compiler, and then I get advantage of all the GCC backends and so forth. Well, this is written about actually by RMS in one of his seminal essays about the GPL called Copyleft Pragmatic Idealism, and he has about two sentences telling this story. So I went looking for more information about it online, and I had remembered that there was a ton of Usenet discussion back in the 90s about it, but it actually goes back further than that, and the earliest Usenet post I could find is this one. But this is obviously very late, because somebody's already released a book about Next, talking about the compiler being based on GCC, and this fellow has gotten a copy of the book. And I'm pretty sure that by the time this post hit Usenet, the violation had long since been resolved. Because within a few days, someone from Next writes back and says that, oh, the Objective-C front end's going to be in the upstream. And the only way this could have happened so quickly, there's no way the enforcement happened in just a matter of 10 days. So it must have happened before that. Now, I'm friends with RMS, and I've asked him to tell me the story, the full story, other than the three lines that's in that one essay about this violation. And very RMS-like, he says, oh, I couldn't possibly remember something from so long ago. And I asked him, I said, well, do you remember if you just talked to Steve Jobs on the phone, or how did you even communicate with Next? He goes, oh, maybe I talked to Steve Jobs on the phone. I don't remember. Now, I'm really glad that our movement of free software is led by a guy who can't remember if he's talked to Steve Jobs on the phone. I think most of us, if we talked to Steve Jobs on the phone, we'd remember. I would. But RMS can't remember. Maybe he did, maybe he didn't. I can't remember. So this is the best evidence we have of the first GPL violation ever. But it creates this chain of events that's really interesting. So Steve Jobs to this day is basically the most anti-GPL person in the world. And if you've read recently, Apple has plans to remove Samba from OS X, and they've written their own SIFS and SMB protocol stuff that they have proprietary, rewrote from scratch so they can get rid of Samba. And the Samba team, I was at their conference earlier this week, and they're pretty upset about this, but I told them that they shouldn't feel bad, because since the 1980s, Steve Jobs has been on a mission to avoid the GPL as much as possible. In fact, today, Apple is working really hard to replace GCC. They are funding LLVM to make a BSD licensed compiler just good enough so that people will abandon GCC and contribute to LLVM, and they're going around convincing developers to stop working on GCC and to work on LLVM. Well, because it's under the BSD license, it means that Apple's gonna make lots of proprietary improvements to LLVM that they won't release. And it's going to basically turn the compiler world into a mixed, some proprietary, some free software infrastructure if we accept this. So we shouldn't accept this. We should continue helping GCC. And during the entire GPLv3 process, Apple spread all sorts of FUD about v3. They continue to do so today and say various things that just aren't true about v3. And and some people say, well, this is an example of why there's a problem with copyleft. I say this is an example why there's success. There is no company in the world that wants more than Apple to make users have no rights or freedoms. They want you to have basically all your data locked up with Apple, all your devices locked up. You can never upgrade a device. If you jailbreak it, they'll brick it. All these sorts of things, that's completely incompatible with software freedom. So GPL is doing its job because Apple is working against everyone's software freedom, and they quite appropriately hate the GPL. So I'm not so bothered by this, but I think it's a good example of what the GPL is trying to do and how it's trying to make sure that people have freedom. And it's directly opposed to companies that are against freedom. So the next era of GPL enforcement was with GNU-TAR. And for those of you that are young in the audience, there was a time when we all had lots and lots and lots of backup tapes. I once worked at a job as a sysadmin, and I had all the drawers in my cubicle filled with 8mm tape because it was all the backups for all the computers. There was a lot of tape needed to back up what would now be considered very small hard drives these days. And every company, every large company, had a tape backup system of some sort, and the best program available to do backups was GNU-TAR in those days. And that's the program they used, and of course, they often violated the GPL. Now, it helped that system administrators are a very curious bunch, and they don't just take some vendor's product and use it mindlessly. They investigate what it's all about, and sysadmins would find these violations of GNU-TAR. They would find that their vendor had given them a product that had GNU-TAR in it, but hadn't given them any source code, and the FSF did enforcement throughout the late 90s and the early 2000s, getting various different GNU-TAR-based backup systems in compliance. In fact, that item I checked in 1999, my first GPL in violation case, was checking someone who had added some encryption features to GNU-TAR and had proprietarized it, and we were trying to get them into compliance. And I continued to work on some of the GNU-TAR enforcement once I went to work for the FSF, and the last one I did was in 2002. And I was rather surprised how it came out, or how it completed. I went to meet the lawyer who bought me lunch, and you always need to worry if a lawyer buys you lunch. And I thought we were meeting to talk about getting their source code released and making sure that they were in compliance with the GPL. And what the lawyer told me was, well, the company's rewritten the product to not have GNU-TAR in it anymore. We've written our own TAR from scratch. And therefore, we don't need to come into compliance because we're not distributing GNU-TAR anymore. So I called our lawyers immediately and said, I want to sue them for violating the GPL. And it's when I learned a very unfortunate truth about GPL enforcement, which is that because we're using copyright law, which doesn't know about copyleft. Like from the copyright law's point of view, copyleft is just a type, rather strange one, but a type of license for copyright. And courts in most of the world don't usually give remedy by saying you must comply with the license you violated. When a court looks at GPL, most of the time the only reason it's looking at it is to determine whether or not there was compliance. Once the court determines there wasn't compliance, the remedy is other things. So what you usually get from the court is you get money for the past infringement, and you get what's called an injunction, which basically says the company can't distribute the program anymore or any of your copyrighted works. Well, in this case, the company had already given us the injunction because they weren't distributing GNU-TAR, and as far as I know, they're still not distributing this particular company GNU-TAR today because they can't. So we got the injunction, and at that point, all that's left is to get some money. So the weird interaction with copyright law is that we can't actually use the courts to order compliance most of the time. We hope that maybe someday we can, but it seems like it might be difficult to get a court to do that. Now, times began to change, and GNU TAR was not so important. Backups became less of a nightmare for sysadmins, and the place that we started seeing GPL software show up out of compliance was in the home wireless router, which by 2003 had become this big part of the industry market. The idea, mostly because I was talking IPv6 before. IPv4 is stupid, and there's not enough addresses, and you need NAT. So you had all these little devices that could give you NAT and put all your computers on the network and so forth. And we found a number of reports about this particular product, the Linksys WRTG. And we called Cisco, who had acquired Linksys just a few weeks before, which turned out to be kind of a nightmare for them, because only weeks after they acquired Linksys, it turned out they were in violation of the GPL, and they had just bought a company that was actively in violation. And this is one of the key points of how we do enforcement. We always try to do enforcement by talking to the company privately first. In the extensive experience I've had, as soon as things go public, it becomes much more difficult to get compliance, because the companies then are afraid and they don't want to talk anymore, and they're worried that they're going to have some sort of backlash in the press, and it's difficult. So unfortunately, someone decided to post this WTRG violation on Slashdot in June. We'd only been talking to Cisco about compliance for about 6 weeks at that point, and everything became more difficult when that happened. The Slashdot story brought people out of the woodwork. Now, I was used to GPL violations, but it seems most people in the world don't know that there's GPL violations happening every day, all the time, constantly, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. So people see Slashdot and they think, oh, somebody violated the GPL again. That's been a couple years. No, it hasn't. But that was the reaction folks had when they saw the Slashdot story, and it got some interest from other copyright holders other than FSF. Up until this point in 2003, the only enforcement of the GPL had been done by the Free Software Foundation. Other copyright holders saw this Linksys thing and wanted to get involved, so we built this thing that we jokingly called it the Coalition of the Willing. If you remember in 2003 what was happening, there was this thing that George Bush was calling the Coalition of the Willing, and we jokingly called this our Coalition of the Willing. We didn't really mean to analogize to that, because for obvious reasons. So the key members of this coalition were Eric Anderson, who had just spent a number of years at that point rewriting BusyBox from scratch and had most of the copyrights in BusyBox by that point, and Howard Velta, who had a number of the copyrights in Linux, particularly on IP tables and its subsystem and user space utilities, which of course all were used in this particular product. So we worked with this coalition, and we got everybody sort of under one banner and went out and did enforcement. And we discovered that Broadcom was in fact the upstream. In fact, Broadcom contacted us because Linksys and Cisco had yelled at them. And this is a time, if you've read news, this is when there was weird things going on at Broadcom. Just search for Broadcom cocaine slave dungeon, and you'll see what I'm talking about. And that was during this period, right? So we have these like hyped up Broadcom executives show up. Oh my gosh, we can't come into compliance. We're going to try, but on this wireless device driver thing, we just can't. They claimed, probably correctly at the time, that the FCC would not allow them to release the source code for the device drivers. The FCC has since fixed that problem, and the FCC is the Federal Communication Commission in the United States. They regulate everything that happens over the air, from radio to wireless technologies. And so the FSF agreed, okay, well, if you come into compliance on everything except for the device drivers, we will declare it okay, and we'll let you continue distributing our software. We'll reinstate your rights under the license. One of the things that happens when people violate the GPL is they lose their right to actively distribute under copyright law until such time as the copyright holder restores it for them. So that's why they can't just keep going. They've lost their license, they have to get it back, and they have to be given back the license by the copyright holder. And the nice thing, and this probably is the only time this has happened, unfortunately, that release of code from Broadcom and Linksys and Cisco launched the OpenWRT community. The OpenWRT initial work was based on that source release that was done. And so it's a great example of where enforcement actually created a free software community that's still active today. But Harold was pretty annoyed. He felt, I mean, it was a year later almost before we had them in compliance, and he felt that we just took too long. And so he felt we should have filed a lawsuit. And he didn't understand why we didn't file a lawsuit. He thought that it was silly that we hadn't. And so he, because he disagreed with FSF's shyness about filing a lawsuit, he launched this thing called gplviolations.org and started filing lawsuits. And I wish Harold were here so I could tell him in person, he was right all along, we should have filed a lawsuit, we were wrong at FSF. And if you see him, tell him that. So I wish we had filed a lawsuit, but I'm glad that Harold did, because he did a bunch of lawsuits here in Germany, and they were all successful. And they basically adjudicated the GPL and showed, at least under German copyright law, that the GPL could be enforced successfully. And in fact, if he hadn't done that, it was really his actions that convinced us in the US that we could file some lawsuits in the US. Because in fact, because of various nuances about German copyright law, it was actually harder for him to do lawsuits than it is for us in the US. So we were convinced if he can be successful in Germany, we can do it in the United States. Now, despite his success, he ran into the same problem, which is the court doesn't order compliance with the license. In a lot of the cases, if you go back to gplviolations.org and look at the history of the successes that Harold had, a lot of them were the court ordering the cease of no more distribution by the company, telling the company they could no longer distribute the software rather than actually ordering compliance. So it's sort of the same problem that we run into in the United States when we sue. Well, meanwhile, we were still continuing. It's not that we stopped enforcement, we just were continuing doing non-lawsuit enforcement, non-litigation enforcement. And GCC had become such a part of the embedded industry, and it was the best compiler available by far over any of the others because it supported so many different architectures. Many of the companies that were interested in embedded systems started making tool chains based on GCC, and they were consistently violating the GPL. And it was really a focus for a number of years, my final years as an employee of the Free Software Foundation up until 2005. I was mostly focusing on enforcing for GCC. The only one that was public during that period was OpenTV. If you go back and search for that on news sites, you'll see that story. Now, one of the things that we were looking at the entire time I was at the Free Software Foundation was how do we fund GPL enforcement? And we had this idea that we could certify compliance, that if companies would come to us with a product ahead of time, we could examine it and certify that it was compliant with the terms of the GPL. And then they could get a rubber stamp, some sort of sticker that went on the box, and consumers could pick that. And once we started doing this work and looking into it, the cheapest we could get it down to for certifying compliance was basically about $10,000 US. And that amount of money was not something people were willing to pay. They just would not pay for compliance, particularly because they kind of knew they could get away with a violation if they wanted to. The fact is that enforcement is very time consuming, and we don't get to every enforcement case. And most companies gamble. They say, well, what's the likelihood we're going to be caught? And they just say, well, why would I buy a compliance certification when I can just wait to see if I'm caught? And so we finally decided that we had to ask for money when we enforced against companies. And it was very difficult for me to make this decision. I didn't feel we should be requiring money when somebody violated the GPL. The goal of GPL enforcement is compliance. It's the freedom of users to modify and improve the software. That's our primary goal. And actually, the lawyer that I've worked with for many years named Dan Ravisher was the one who convinced me. And he convinced me by asking me this question. Ultimately, who should be the people paying for enforcement? Should it be the people who are in compliance, or should it be those who violated the license? A great example is Red Hat, which it donates to many organizations. It doesn't donate to Conservancy, but it donates to the FSF, who does enforcement. And Red Hat is basically, as far as I know, never violated the GPL. I've never been told of a case where Red Hat violated the GPL. And yet, through its donations, it was funding GPL enforcement. So it's not really fair to ask somebody like Red Hat or any other company that's consistently in compliance with the GPL to subsidize the enforcement against their competitors who undercut them by violating the GPL. That seems unfair. So we should ask the violators to at least cover the cost of enforcing the GPL. Because the only other option is that when these nonprofits like the Software Freedom Conservancy and the Free Software Foundation do enforcement, they're being also supported by individuals who give money, and I hope you'll donate to both the FSF and Conservancy and support us. But when you do, I don't want to spend your money on enforcement. I want to spend it on other activities for the community that these organizations do. If we're spending it on enforcement, you're, as individual donors, subsidizing GPL violators. And that seems wrong as well. Finally, the final key reason is there must be some deterrent. If the only penalty for violating GPL is when you're caught, you have to come into compliance, just by simple game theory, no one will ever comply voluntarily. They will say, well, I'll just violate and see if anybody comes after me. And if they do, all I have to do is fulfill the requirements I would have had to fulfill before, so I'll just see what happens. So we have to make a deterrent such that companies will be inspired to comply with the GPL from the start. And I think it's important that the enforcement happen through nonprofit organizations. For example, I know the US system better, but in the United States, if you're a 501c3 charity, which both the Software Freedom Conservancy and the Free Software Foundation are, you have to file every year paperwork for the general public to see where all your money comes from and how you spent it. So you can look at this Form 990, it's called in the United States, and see what money came in from enforcement and how our organizations have spent it, and we have accountability to the public in that regard. Now, it's true that you can't get a list of which violators paid how much, but that's primarily because the violators don't want us to tell. And we're generally willing to agree to that confidentiality because the goal in agreeing is that they're going to come into compliance. And so we often just offer anything that's not unrelated to compliance that we can to encourage them. And if they say, well, we don't want to tell anybody how much we paid you for being out of compliance, we generally agree as long as they're going to actually come into compliance with the license and actually give people the source code they deserve. Now, it's also true that use GPL for bad as well. And this is something that took me a while to realize. But there is this idea, a business model that some people call dual licensing. I don't call it that because I think it's confusing because there's other things that are dual licensing that mean something different. I call it proprietary relicensing. It's a case where a for-profit company holds all the copyright on software, some software package. And MySQL, particularly when it was still part of MySQL AB before the Sun acquisition, and then later the Oracle acquisition, they held all the copyright on MySQL. And if you contributed to MySQL, you had to they wouldn't take your patch unless you assigned all your copyrights to MySQL AB. Now, the FSF accepts copyright assignment too, but it promises that it will always release it as free software and it will never make it proprietary software. MySQL AB made no such promises. In fact, what they did is they went and enforced the GPL as a for-profit endeavor. And they tried to make as much money as they could by doing GPL enforcement. Now the problem is when your primary and perhaps only goal in doing GPL enforcement is to make the maximum amount of money, it basically becomes corrupt. By the end of the MySQL AB era, right before the Sun purchase, MySQL salespeople would go to companies and say, if you write SQL statements and your server happens to be MySQL, notwithstanding that the same SQL statements might work on Postgres, doesn't matter. You are a derivative work of MySQL, they would say. Now, I know more about what is and is not a violation of the GPL probably than anybody in the world. And I can assure you that writing SQL statements does not create a derivative work of some SQL server that you might use. But most people don't know that, and they didn't call me to ask. So when the MySQL salespeople come along and say, we're going to sue you for copyright infringement unless you buy a proprietary license for MySQL, well, a lot of companies caved and bought proprietary licenses they didn't need. Now, it took me a very long time to realize that this was completely corrupt. And I wish I'd realized sooner. And this is why I try to be as transparent as what we're doing as possible, because I don't want to become corrupt like this. But on the other hand, money is not my primary goal. The only reason I'm even willing to ask for money is so that we can fund the enforcement and so that we don't lose money doing GPL enforcement. But when profit is your goal in GPL enforcement, I think it's basically a manipulation of the GPL. Now, by mid-2006, the embedded software world had adopted BusyBox and Linux wholesale. It was the primary operating system used on almost every embedded device. And you look in the router market or the network attached storage market, or basically any market that has a small computer in the device. These days, most televisions are running BusyBox and Linux. Most DVD players are running BusyBox and Linux. So this embedded market had adopted wholesale this software and was mostly violating the GPL. And Eric, who was at the time basically the primary copyright holder in BusyBox, today he holds the plurality of copyrights, he came and asked for help. And BusyBox was a member of the Software Freedom Conservancy. I have a whole talk about what conservancy is, but generally it's a nonprofit home for projects. Projects join, they become part of conservancy, and then we provide a nonprofit infrastructure so they can have a nonprofit home like GNOME Foundation does for GNOME and FSF does for the GNU project. Conservancy does it for a bunch of different projects as well. And so Conservancy decided, I was president of Conservancy, that we would serve as an enforcement agent for copyright holders of GPL programs, BusyBox being the first one we did this for. And also, at this point, many developers other than Eric have assigned their copyright to Conservancy. And so we also have copyrights in BusyBox of our own. Well, as soon as we announced that we were doing enforcement for BusyBox, the list of violations grew to 100 rather quickly, within like 6 to 8 months. Today, I have a list of more than 300 GPL violations that I'm actively aware of. I work on very few of those by percentage. I try to triage them as best I can, but there are a lot of GPL violations. And this is basically, the volume is the reason I believe that lawsuits are necessary. We have to draw attention to the fact that there are violations and that there are consequences if you violate. The Conservancy is represented by two attorneys in the United States named Dan Ravisher and Aaron Williamson. They filed lawsuits for Conservancy as well as for Eric Anderson. We're currently in litigation right now in the United States against Best Buy and various other companies. My lawyers always say don't comment on ongoing litigation. So other than drawing your attention to the fact that it's happening, I'm not going to say more about that. But I will say that anytime we file a lawsuit, our goal is to not go to trial. We don't actually want to have a big trial because we want to settle and get compliance. Because remember that the court, if we go to trial, the likely thing they're going to give us is money and an injunction, not compliance with a license. And what we want is compliance. We don't want people to stop using GPL software. We want them to use it more, but use it in compliance. So we want to settle with an agreement that brings them into compliance, not just on what we're enforcing over, like BusyBox, but any GPL or LGPL software in the firmware, because usually it's a firmware filled with GPL software. BusyBox, Linux, UC libc, or maybe glibc, lots of stuff under GPL and LGPL. Now, the reason we can ask for this at all is because they lost their right to distribute BusyBox. So what we say is, well, you no longer have permission to distribute BusyBox. We won't restore that permission until you come into compliance on everything. So that's how we're able to ask for that and have it be a legitimate request. And we're not likely to get a judge to grant us that. And we try to get a settlement agreement that will work. If we have to, well, we're going to have to take money and an injunction because that's what the court's likely to give us. But that's a last resort. That's just basically means we didn't succeed in the best way possible. The succeeding in the best way possible is to settle the lawsuit and have a GPL-compliant distribution. So my last part of the history story is this strange thing that happened with Linksys. So right after we settled the situation with Linksys and the WRT 54G source code was released, OpenWRT was starting up, I called up the general counsel of Cisco, whose name was Sherman Chu. He's now the head of their Chinese division. And I said, Sherman, I want to thank you. I know it's been a difficult process. I'm glad you're in compliance. I hope you feel good about this, and I hope you, continue to make products and stay in compliance. And Sherman said, this process has been so horrible, we're never going to use GPL software again, and hung up on me. And it was true for about a year. If you look at the Linksys products that were released during that period, all of them used VxWorks. And my theory, I don't know this for a fact, is that Sherman made an edict that no GPL software would be used in Cisco or Linksys. The problem is that there's no way to do these products without using GPL software, because GPL software is the best tool for the job. So slowly, they start to put more Linux back into their products and more BusyBox. And of course, it was in violation, because here's what happened, right? You issue an edict to a bunch of engineers and say you can't do this. Well, they're going to do what the right thing engineering-wise is anyway, but then they're not going to tell anybody. And so that's what happens. Also, there's this upstream problem I got to talk about in a minute. So the FSF gets fed up and had to sue Cisco and Linksys ultimately, upsetting Red Hat quite a bit, which is a story I'll tell you offline if you want to hear it. It's pretty simple. If you look at the dates, Red Hat signed a deal with Cisco 3 weeks after the Cisco lawsuit was filed. So draw your own conclusions. But the weird thing is why didn't they just, Cisco knew that there was this thing called GPL at that point. They weren't unaware. Why is it that they didn't come into compliance? Well, we have a different type of GPL violation today than we did at the beginning of the story. What I call a savvy violator, a violator who's aware of GPL and trying to get around it, like Jobs was with Objective-C, well, they're going to try to get away with it, and when they're stopped, they're just going to stop, because they say, well, we're caught. And so the problem with most violators today is I have a conversation like this with them. And they don't even know that there's software in their device, ultimately. And if I seem a little strange sometimes, this is why. And this conversation is an insane conversation to have. And most violators like that are today because they don't know what they got. They got it from somebody else. And they just pass it along and think, well, I'm just passing along what I got. How could I possibly have infringed any rights? And the suppliers, frankly, are not helping. And I can't get the downstreams to do anything. Because I say, well, why don't you just tell me? Tell me they violated when they gave it to you. I'll go after them. I won't bother you anymore. Because if you were a victim of a GPL violation, I want to solve that for you as best I can. But no one will ever, as we say in the US, turn state's evidence. I'll say, just tell me, and they'll say, well, we'll just take care of it. I think these upstreams are really bullying the downstreams on stuff. Now, the key problem, I don't have much time left, but I want to talk about is this issue of what we're trying to get when we get compliance these days. Most of the software is not modified all that much. But what we need to be able to do is to build the software and install it onto the devices. And the problem I run into is trying to get a source package that will build, will install, and to get it before the product's discontinued. And this is a huge challenge. And of course, they delay it as much as they can in the hopes that I won't catch them in time and they'll just release another product and I'll have to chase the next product. Now, both versions of GPL have text that deal with this problem. There is this thing in GPL v2 that says the scripts that control compilation and installation of the executable, a phrase that I have three characters in Emacs to expand to because I have to write it so much. And this gets us most of what we want. It handles these issues. The problem is getting people to give us those scripts and have scripts work is really, really difficult. And I sort of have a whole talk about this detail. If you want more information, you can see me later. And I think it even includes this issue of authorized DRM installation, although, frankly, RMS has said that it doesn't, so there's not much I can do about that. But fortunately, GPL v3 has even better language, a much expanded version of this requirement, and it's therefore a much better license because it's very clear that scripts to control compilation and installation, that's a very terse phrase. But this is an expanded definition that's very clear about what's required. I think it just clarifies v2, but regardless, it makes it really certain as to what's happening. And it makes sure that users can do what the four freedoms say they ought to be allowed to do, which is modify their own devices and install modified versions. That's essential. And I think projects should upgrade to V3 because it will make it very clear that users ought to have this right. Now, I think they have this right under V2 as well. Those words mean something in GPL V2. There has to be something called the scripts to control compilation and installation of the executable. But I think V3 makes it even clearer and will help us. So this is a pretty sad story, frankly. I'm doing GPL enforcement at Conservancy. It's about 30% of my time. I get a new report every week, at least. Matthew Garrett's recently gotten interested. He's doing some enforcement, particularly on Android devices, which is very good. That's the Android tablet market is what he's extremely concerned about. I am also involved with the FSF, and their queue is just as long as Conservancy's of waiting violations. And Armin Hemmel is a guy who's running GPLviolations.org now, but he's doing it as a volunteer. He has time when he has time, and there's not a ton of enforcement going on. The stuff Harold Belt is doing on GSM is really important. He's writing great software, so I'm glad he's doing that rather than GPL enforcement, because frankly what he's doing is probably more important right now. But in the end, that leaves us with fewer people doing GPL enforcement. There's violations everywhere. And the only thing we can do is have constant vigilance. Every time we see a violation, do something about it. If you find them, email them to me. Email the company and tell them that you have a right to source code. And the fact is, I can find a violation anytime. Anybody want to take this bet? You shouldn't, because I'll win. You could just search on the internet for firmware. The first hit will be a GPL violation. Now, I know about the ones on the first five pages of searches, but I just click clicking next and eventually I find a new one, every time. It's just too easy and unfortunate. So here are some URLs you can check and if you want to report a violation, there's where to email me to report a violation. And this ends on a sad note because there's hundreds of violations queued and we hope to resolve as many as we can, but we don't have that much by way of people willing to do it. And with that, I'll take questions.
Well, are there any questions in the audience? Yep.
You said that you, for GPL version 2, you use the fact that just the copyright holder can give permission again to, mm-hmm. well, for some...
Yeah, and that's true under V3 as well.
The version 3 does not have this death penalty.
It does. It has the same. There is a timeout period. So under V3, you have 60 days to come into compliance, and then the rights are restored. I've never met a company that can come into compliance in 60 days because they're so inept, basically. So you tell them they have 60 days, and then, well, the 60 days pass, and then it's exactly the same as V2.
Okay.
In my experience, the most problem is the word derived work, what is also in GPL. Can you say a few words about what is a derived work?
Well, you're wrong about that, because most of the GPL violations have nothing to do with the derived work issue. That's the difference between the savvy violator and the unsavvy one. A lot of people ask about it. You're correct that people love to ask about it. And the problem is they're asking the wrong people. Because GPL, like I was saying, it's a copyright license and relies on copyright law. Derivative work and derived work are terms from copyright law. And we have to look to copyright law to tell us what is or is not a derivative work. And it's not our fault that we use copyright law. We're just a user of that library. And maybe there's a bug in that library, I don't know. There's certainly confusion in that library. And I'm waiting for them to fix the library. Now, it takes a long time for courts to do this, because what is a derivative work of a software program is debated heavily. I know in the US, there are different standards in different areas of court, so the different federal circuits in the US have different standards, but the GPL's goal is to use whatever copyright law gives us. So everybody wants me to define what a derivative work is. You're gonna have to ask judges to do that. I have some ideas, right? I'm not giving you our time. I mean, this is, some people very aggressive, you're not being aggressive, but there are lawyers who are aggressive, and the reason they're being aggressive is they want us to water down the GPL. because they want us to define it in GPL. The strong copyleft is always designed to go as far as copyright law will take us. And that's the whole thing about using the tools of oppressor against the oppressor, because we have to go as far as they go, because we have to match them at every turn. Now, LGPL is a compromise, and LGPL does define certain types of derivative works you can make that are permitted, and it's pretty clear about what is and is not permitted, but that's a weaker copyleft. So in the strong copyleft case, we're just going to go as far as we can where copyright law will take us. And if we get into a dispute about it, if it ever actually happens, which it really never has, we'll just go to court. No one's ever disagreed with me about what is or not a derivative work when I've done GPL enforcement, because it's not the issue that comes up. I mean, it came up with Steve Jobs, and that's the last time it really came up as the center of a GPL enforcement. Most GPL enforcements, the modifications are very, very minimal, and they're done directly, and it's obviously a derivative work.
More questions from the audience? I have a question. Have you ever thought about implementing some kind of, well, financial or similar penalties into the licenses itself?
I think that something like that would just be prone for abuse. I mean, there are licenses that are free software licenses out there that do that, that basically try to recover attorney's fees and all this sort of thing. The penalties under copyright law are there, and they're financial. If we need to chase a financial penalty, we will. My goal is not to have money being the center of it. I only ask for enough money to basically cover my cost of bringing you into compliance. And I don't want to see more of that. I mean, I guess you could write that in the GPL, but I think it would be a mistake because I think people would abuse it. It's better if we just use the copyright system as it stands. That's the design of GPL, and I think we should stick with that design and just use whatever copyright law gives us in that regard.
Okay, one last question.
How is the situation of a competitor? For example, if Red Hat has a business model based on the GPL, say, in theory, could sue everybody who is violating the GPL because they are destroying the business model. And so they could go for much, much more money than you ever would imagine. This is typical for the copyright companies. And are there any companies on the copyright
area? Well, I mean, I gave one example. MySQL, that was their business model. I mean, that was their business model.
And I think, is it... Could it be not the central business model, but helpful to educate all these companies, or is it? I think you are a little bit you should be a little bit more aggressive about fighting for the GPL.
Well, I'm pretty aggressive. I mean, I do. Enforcement has been a major part of my life for 12 years. I don't know if I could do more. I could sleep less, I guess. I think more individual copyright holders have to do enforcement. That's the real problem. I don't want to see companies starting to do it because I think companies would have dubious motives. Individual developers, I think, would do it for the sake of GPL. If a company starts doing enforcement, they're probably doing it to make money. And there are projects, Samba's a good example, that won't accept corporate copyright into it because they don't want companies to abuse their copyrights in Samba. In this way, to try and foil their competitors, because their fear is that they'll use it to shut their competitors down. And so, because they can get this injunction, you can stop somebody from using the product. And if the goal is going to be stop people and get money, that's something we should only accept when there's no other recourse. The primary goal has to be compliance. And when you have for-profit companies, their primary goal is always profit. It's always making money. So they're going to focus on that, not compliance with the license. So I really wish more individual copyright holders would follow Harold's example and get involved in enforcement. It's just a lot of them don't want to because in turn they'll upset their companies. Strangely, most companies that rely on GPL software, and I don't fully understand why, hate GPL enforcement. Red Hat doesn't like it. Most companies don't like GPL enforcement. They have the sense that it destabilizes and all these other things. So they try to avoid it, and they won't let their employees do GPL enforcement on their own copyrights most of the time. So that's why there's so few people, because they're afraid their employer's going to get mad at them if they enforce the GPL. So we need more nonprofits doing enforcement. That's, I think, the answer ultimately.
Well, so thank you very much, Bradley, for your keynote.
Thank you.
Great to have you here.